Welcome back to The Rate of Change with York Wealth Management. As advisor to some of the wealthiest families in the country, The Rate of Change is a podcast designed to help you in the pursuit of building long-term wealth through the insights of some of the brightest minds in asset management. I'm your host, Murdoch Gaddy, and in today's podcast, we're bringing you something a little bit different, introducing Quarterly Insights with Jason Coggins. I think you're really going to benefit from Jason's perspectives. And for those unfamiliar with Jason, he is one of the leading industry minds in strategic asset allocation, wealth management, and economics. He's worked with some of the biggest names in the industry, from the banks, ANZ, CBA, to very, very wealthy wealth management firms, Coda Capital, and currently advises five major institutions and family offices. We're very fortunate to have him as the investment committee chair at the Hasten Huang Family Office and Initium, with whom York Wealth Management is proud to be partnered. This insight series focuses on strategic asset allocation and macroeconomic themes. If you're a client of York and you were lucky enough to join us live last week, I really hope you found his insights as valuable as we did. If you're not a client and would like to attend future strategy sessions, as this current episode will always be a delayed release, feel free to reach out and would love to have you at our next quarterly live broadcast. We're also pleased to introduce our soon-to-be high net worth family client advisor, who is currently an associate, Anthony Adlam, who will be introducing and organizing the Insight series going forward. Before we get into the conversation, please remember this broadcast is made for entertainment purposes only. Past performance is not a reliable indicator of future returns, and today's discussion is intended to help you better understand the lay of the land, what's currently happening in the world, and where you should be thinking about allocating your assets going forward. It is not personal advice. If you need advice, just reach out and we'll happily work with you in your portfolio. I encourage you to listen to the disclaimer at the end of the podcast, and as always, keep your feedback coming. You can reach me at mgatty@ywm.com.au. With that being said, I hope you enjoyed this conversation as much as we did. So sit back, relax, and enjoy.
Everyone, to Insights with York Wealth Management. My name is Anthony Adlam. I'm an associate here at York Wealth, and I'd like to extend a thank you to all of us for you joining us here today, not only the families and individuals as well, to this forum. Now, today we're lucky enough to be hearing from Jason Coggins, Investment Committee Chair at Initium Capital and the Hasten and Huang Family Office. Furthermore, also joined by Murdoch Gaddy, as you can see on your screens here, founder of York Wealth and host of the podcast Rate of Change. We felt that given the current climate we're experiencing, not only financially markets, but politically, pending the current election as well, it was more important than ever to open a forum such as this. Furthermore, we'll be seeking to run this sort of asset allocation strategy session monthly, designed in the sort of assist in the pursuit of building our portfolios holistically. Now, our conversation this afternoon is directed to current events, covering a wide range of topics such as globalization, reverse, and Trump and his tariffs and the like, and then obviously RBA cuts imminent, Australian property outlooks, and the upcoming election impact markets as well. Also, we'll delve into many tangents that Jason and Murdoch may explore during the conversation, and we look forward to seeing what gets unpacked along the way. Just in terms of housekeeping today as well, given the interactive nature of the session, if you do have any questions during the discussion, feel free to drop them. There's a chat box located on the right of your screen there. Feel free to drop them in there, or there's a typing option available. Also, if you can just wait to the end as well, we do open up to the forum. You can save them there for Jason and Murdoch as well. We'll be addressing some of the pre-submitted questions that was available via our registration form too, so that'll also be looked at in time, and then we'll open the floor up in an open forum as well. Regarding technical issues that anyone may experience, feel free to message me directly. I'll assist as best I can once we get the discussion underway. But without further ado, I will hand over now to Murdoch and Jason. So, gents, take it away, Murdoch.
Welcome, everyone. Glad to have you with us. Jason, why don't we kick off like we always do in the podcast and tell everyone a little bit about yourself, you know, what you've been doing before the family office and, you know, what you're currently doing now.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for taking the afternoon to listen to this podcast. So, again, we're going to make this interactive. So, look, for the past 20 years, I've been involved in financial services, primarily in investing, consulting and researching. So in the last 10 years, I was at a private wealth firm, quite a large private wealth firm nationally, where my colleague and I built out the investment capabilities. So that started with a blank sheet of paper. It involved creating a philosophy, identifying investments, traveling the world, and most importantly, talking to clients and making sure that those investments are applicable and right for them. Before private wealth, I was, you know, at ANZ, where I led the advice research team, which included a whole lot of advisors, at one point over 2,000. And before that, consulting, institutional asset consulting.
Thanks, Jason. Why don't we always kick off with the elephant in the room, the fun one. There's been a very, very large shift in government over in the States that everyone's aware of. I think one client joked to me that after he watched Squid Game on Netflix, that it kind of feels like red light, green light. You go to bed, you think it's one way, then you wake up, you know, it's completely done a backflip and it's just changing red to green on the screens continuously. So I think we're discussing, Jason, you mentioned that you think globalization is now in reverse. So with all these changes coming through, you know, where do we actually stand, you know, from an asset allocation perspective? What's currently happened and where do you think it's going?
So, look, I wouldn't go so far to say it's reversing. It is ultimately changing. Now, I also think we need to look at the context in how the president, President Trump, negotiates. Now, you don't have to like the guy, and a lot of people don't, but he has a very unique approach, almost bullying into what he does. Now, what I would caution is what he says 1 minute will ultimately change. And it's almost to get everybody confused. And then therefore he has an apparent, lift in negotiating, right? So I think what ultimately occurs is very different to what he says initially. Now, I do think what you will see, and what you've already started to see, right or wrong, the US believes it's got the short end of the straw in terms of trade, has a lot of free trade with other countries. It's not reciprocated. And so I think what they're trying to do is get some quick wins. I wouldn't look at the rhetoric and say they want to produce iPhones or they want to produce textiles in the US. They're simply making a lot of noise and they want to renegotiate trade deals. Now, if you saw where the first tariffs came out, there was about 20 countries seeking access to the White House to negotiate fair trade. That's really what I think. So I don't think it's in reverse. I do think what you will see, and this has really been happening since his first term, is you're very likely to see supply chains globally alter. And instead of having a single global supply chain, which was based in China, you're effectively going to have regional supply chains. So you'll have a supply chain closer to the US. You'll have a supply chain closer to the Middle East. You'll have a supply chain closer to Europe. Now, the issue is moving from one supply chain to multiple supply chains and even ignoring the cost to develop that, that will be inflationary. So I do think while inflation is coming down, it's definitely down from the peaks inspired by COVID, supply chain disruptions, and also the Ukraine war. Inflation has come down, but I think it is ultimately sticky with tariffs and changes to supply chains.
So the one thing between you and I, the thing when I'm allocating capital, that's just quite been on my mind is like, what does this actually mean? So when you say that, you know, the Trump government has said a whole bunch of crazy stuff and to bring people to the table and start renegotiating, a lot of the biggest question was, okay, where did he get the percentages for from the tariffs, right? But can you explain, to me, like take Japan as an example. Japan may have very low percentage tariffs, but I think Donald Trump even said if you try to sell rice back into China or say take Australia, like everyone's like, oh, you should never have stuck a tariff on Australia. But he's like, hold on a second, US can't sell beef into Australia. His argument was something along the lines that they technically, these countries do have tariffs, but they're not technically a tariff. They're like a firm barrier to entry, and it's only like one way. Like the Japanese can sell whatever they want, cars, you name it, straight in one way, but it's not reciprocal the other direction. So can you explain that? And then potentially the other thought I'm having is when we're looking at a lot of, say, these companies, US, and you're talking about how they restructure and where and how things change, is this going to necessarily change the profitability of these companies or the capacity, the ability for them to actually do business in particular countries? Is it going to, you know what I mean? That's essentially what I'm thinking.
Yeah, so back to my first point. I don't think he's looking for a complete reorganization of globalization. But to your point, it's exactly that, right? So, you know, there are trade barriers that are set up despite of having free trade. And so that's his focus. Now, to your point, what does this mean for investment implications? Now, I don't think you want to be second-guessing or predicting how policy will evolve. But at Initium, we spoke, you know, late December, early January, to frame up some of our views on markets. And we had three core themes that we thought we should look at. And this becomes important in the context of what happens in the US and whether or not profitability stays up. So the first theme that we had, we wanted to be underweight US dollars and we want to be overweight rest of the world. I think after trade, he will then go for an orderly managed accord to have a lower US dollar. That is really the only way to support US trade. The second, we saw, you know, two standard deviation, three standard deviation extreme valuations in the US market versus the rest of the world. And we viewed having an underweight position to the US market, not a 0% weight, but an underweight position. And remember, the US market was 75% of the MSCI world. It was huge. It was overrepresented. We thought, you know, particularly with the German election in the first quarter of the year, that Europe looked cheap and Asia looked cheap. And lastly, particularly given the massive growth in index funds with the preference to be invested in the US market, huge amounts of flows were being directed into the mega caps in the US. And we said it's probably time to downweight those. So non-USD, rest of the world over the USD, and then also non-mega caps. Now, to your point, what does it mean for US companies? The reason we took that view was you can't predict what will happen. But where US valuations were, you were not being paid up to take the risk, right? Valuations were so high that if something went wrong, the market was going to fall quite heavily. Now, we knew tariffs were coming. That was, he campaigned on that. One of the events that I don't think we saw coming was DeepSeek and AI, the progress that China has made. And that really threw a spanner in the works around valuations of the big AI companies in the US. Now, that's not to say they are very high quality, but when they're trading at 30, 40, 50 times earnings, there's not much room for error.
Yeah. So can you explain a bit more the potential opportunity in Europe? Because we're talking about, if you think about Europe, right, everyone thinks about how the banks fell over. You know, the pigs are horrible. You know, there's debt everywhere. You know, there's bureaucracy and people can't, you know, actually manage Greece properly. But we've had a conversation and you're saying that potentially the opportunity lies in Europe. Do you want to give a bit of color around that and the thinking?
So there's a couple of angles here. So after the banking crisis with Portugal, Italy, Greece, and Spain, there's been a lot of reform in some of those countries. So I would now say that Spain and Greece and Portugal are showing much stronger rates of growth and much stronger rates of reform than what we see even in Australia. So how things change, and it changes pretty quickly. Now, what Europe does in times of crises, they do work very well together. And so they are increasingly working together. You also had the German elections, which resulted in a very pro-fiscal stance. So if you think about the German DNA, they don't like deficits and they don't like inflation. And so they have had a very balanced budget since World War. Now, what they've committed to doing, because growth is so slow, is really having a massive fiscal spending program. And this is not just in defense. This is across the entire economy. So when you've got, and then you've got the other countries who are endorsing that within the EU. So even if, you know, Germany recorded, massive deficits, larger than what we see most countries now. They could do that for 5 to 10 years and still be the second lightest geared country from a fiscal perspective. So there's a lot of capacity there. So I look at the region as a whole. You know, I think France just does its own thing. It's not really interested in growing or reforming. You've got Germany who's going to spend. You've got Italy who's, you know, it's an older population, but there's definitely a reformist element in that government. And then Greece, Spain is booming. And Portugal. So I think it's an interesting market. Look, the market has rallied substantially. So that was one of the things we thought would happen. It was really dependent upon the German election. I still think relative valuations are still pretty cheap. I mean, a lot of companies have gone up significantly, but I think that fiscal boost over the next couple of years is going to be very powerful.
So we've seen a lot of the banks, like in the UK, Barclays Bank, and a lot of the banks actually put up some serious returns. I think Barclays is up something like nearly 80% for the past 12 months. But what inside Europe, what specifically are the subsectors that are of interest in Europe?
Look, I try not to take an overly micro approach to things. So, you know, my role is to be very macro driven and find strategies. But really, if you think about what's happening in Europe, there's economic reform, so that's broadly positive for the entire market. You've got population growth, and you've got defence spending. So there's some of the key themes you would expect portfolio managers to look at. But I think, you know, it's a rich hunting ground, that market. You know, a lot of people have spent a lot of time in the US. I think every portfolio in the domestic space here is overweight US markets, by and large, because it made up such a large part of the index. But, you know, the interesting... You know, there's interesting companies in Germany. Now, if we go to China, for example, whether or not the market's investable or not, it's rallied a lot this year on its ability to demonstrate, whether or not you believe it or not, that they can do AI with, you know, a hundredth of the cost and a quarter of the processing speeds for chips. Now, I've always had the view on China. It's very dangerous to bet against China. Now, that doesn't mean you have to have an investment in it. It doesn't mean you have to have a large investment in it. But if you think about the top 1% of people in China, be it entrepreneurs, be it scientists, being engineers, and compare that to the top 1% in the US, they are as good, potentially better. So the innovation capability within that economy, it would be very dangerous to ignore that.
It's interesting you mentioned the economy in China over the past 30 years. What they went from rice farmers to an extent large part of the population. They just completely built up the middle class, you know, at the expense of, say, the US class. So I think the biggest, what I'm hearing right now is a lot of the reform essentially is dictating which way you think the wind's blowing based on a macro component. Is that fair? And where I'm going with this is if other governments are thinking from a reform perspective, the only way to fix their economy is to essentially help build up their middle class right across the board, just like what China's done for the past number of years. Do you think that strategy is actually going to help the middle class? And will that overflow to Australia or like bring back manufacturing and that type of thing, or just a long journey ahead?
No, so I think China, in saying quite positive of what's happened in the last year in the market, it still has very large structural issues, right? So a very aging population, significantly aging population. You've got large amounts of debt levels in some parts of the economy. You've got a lot of idle infrastructure, and you've got the dreaded deflation. And so when your population, and you've got, you know, people not really having children. So it looks like a deflationary time bomb. And we saw that happen to Japan over 20, 30 years. But it is a very large economy. Now, on the idea that we can recreate our middle class, Australia is not going to be able to do that through manufacturing. We don't have a comparative advantage in that. We don't have the size of the population, and we are very far away from the rest of the world. The only way to restore the middle class is through economic reform. Removing the impediments of doing business in this country, making it easier to employ people, making it easier to build and develop things. Now, unfortunately, that has been, you know, absent in Australian policy for the good part of the last two decades.
So speaking of Australia, we got an election on. A lot's been happening the past 3 years. What do you think is going to happen there? Do you think potentially whoever gets in are going to make those reforms to benefit Australians, or is this the same and same again? And what do you think is happening, you know, for the Australian election?
So in saying that, I shouldn't be too hard on Australia. The economy is still doing okay. I think that, you know, one thing that we're very good at is population growth. And so we have a naturally increasing population over time. I think when you want to invest in Australia, you know, the top 20 companies don't look that interesting to me. You have this very interesting concept in Australia. The large superannuation inflows every month that we receive, you know, 20 to 30% of that makes its way into the ASX, and that makes its way into the top 20 companies. So we call it the lowest cost of capital in the world, right? Because these companies just, they stay at high valuations because there is so much money coming in the market. Despite the ASX, for example, this will be the third consecutive year where the ASX 20 earnings have gone backwards. Now, I think where some of the more interesting things in the market is where the super funds can't play. Now, despite not having productivity reform, you know, our small companies, our universities, and our entrepreneurs still punch above their weight globally. So I think certain segments in small and mid-caps in the Australian market is very interesting. And then also some of the more private equity, private market plays, where you're really in that lower mid-market segment, where you're not competing against, again, big super funds or institutional investors. So there's opportunities here, but like any market, you have to be extremely, extremely selective.
The one thing we talk a lot about in the Australian market is private credit. We dig into this quite a bit. It's discussed a number of the major players in the Australian market on the podcast as well. But my question is, considering the, well, as you mentioned, the ASX won an average return something like 8%. Some of these private creditors and private lenders are doing, you know, 10%, you know, higher for asset backed, less volatility. Do you think the private credit Australian market is better than the international market from a regulation or robustness? And do you think it's here to stay? Is there any risk associated to this particular space?
Okay, so before I answer that, I'm going to say that I work, you know, with a few groups, families, and some other wealth managers, and people have different views on this. Now, I'm going to be very clear, very, very, very clear. I think there's a role for different assets in portfolios. So I think the debate private credit versus liquid credit versus offshore private credit misses the whole point. Now, I will be on record to state that I'm very bullish on local private debt. Now, if you think about what local private credit is, it is bridge financing by and large. And by and large, it's 80% asset-backed lending. So it's against a physical hard asset like a property or a shopping center or an office tower versus cash flow lending to corporates in the small to medium size range, which is probably a little bit more risky. Now, if I think about the Australian market, it's still largely in its infancy. We have, and what I mean by that, it's still relatively new. And so the inefficiencies within that market is really great. Now, despite all the hysteria in the media, and I think these are probably competitors to the asset class making a lot of noise, we have not seen any systemic risk in the asset class. We have not seen any instances of poor underwriting. We have not seen any instances of declining underwriting. And we have not seen many instances of default rates. Now, people can claim that the asset class hasn't gone through a stress point or a cycle. Yes, it has. This asset class was around pre-COVID. It was around during lockdowns. It was, you know, it was there when, you know, we were closed off to the world. And it was there when we had a rapid normalization of interest rates from 0 to 4.6% or wherever it was. So the asset class has been tested. Now, the most important thing, and I think this gets missed by some of the journalists who are trying to get a gotcha moment, the fact of the matter is that this asset class has two massive structural tailwinds that are permanent. One, the economy needs lending, and banks simply aren't going to do it in certain segments. Because they haven't trained underwriters and they haven't done it for a long period of time. So the economy needs lending to grow. That's not going to change. And second of all, as the demographics change, as we get older and as people move to, you know, retirement and deaccumulation, they will want higher income. Now, one final aspect on the dynamic of Australian private credit, it is by and large bridge financing. It's not long-term loans. It can be anywhere from 6 months to 12 months to 24 months. That's important for a number of reasons. If you lend on a 7-year basis, things change. A sector may not be around. Inflation may go from really high to really low. You know, we may have a prolonged recession, or the asset just deteriorates. Bridge financing, shorter term, not as many things can go wrong. Now, lastly, on private credit, Australia has some of the best credit protection rights in the world. It's universally regarded. When a loan goes pear-shaped, the key is to fix it. And so the discussion should not be around whether or not private credit is systemically sick. It's actually, you want a manager who can go in and get their hands dirty and fix a loan and do it quickly. It's asset-backed. You don't want to see that deteriorate. Now, that's very different to the US market, where you have Chapter 11 and you have no control, and it's extremely value-destructive. So there's some really unique attributes of Australian private credit. The structural thematics, you know, are there. People want income. People need lending. But in saying all of that, it's not one or nothing. So a lot of the discussion has been, don't have private credit because you should be invested in listed credit. I think that misses the complete point, and it's more around competitors trying to position their own product.
That makes a lot of sense. You said that was the last thing on private credit, but one of the biggest questions that we get from clients is, you know, people keep, RBA keeps discussing rate cuts. You know, you did say it did survive practically zero. It's gone back up. It's talking about it coming back off. You know, what does potential a rate cutting schedule look like, say, for, you know, Aussie equities, the Australian market, property, and, you know, same thing, private credit. What does that look like?
Let's start with private credit, and let's then go into bonds, and then we'll go to equity markets and not. So look, private credit, interesting. So private credit, and apologies for the jargon, it's not typically a spread product. So when you mortgage, you know, you have a mortgage, interest rates are cut, your cost of interest goes down. It's not how private credit works. Private credit is typically a fixed rate asset class, and it is less influenced by interest rates. It will charge, you know, for, you know, some type of bridge financing anywhere from 6 to 12%. And that will be largely independent of the interest rate cycle or where interest rates are, and really largely reflective around how much the asset is worth and how much value is going to be created by lending to it. So interest rate sensitivity to private credit is not really there. Where it becomes interesting, if term deposits become lower, if alternatives to private credit become lower, then private credit becomes more advantageous, and its role in a portfolio is very important. In terms of traditional bonds, so absolutely traditional bonds might have a role in a portfolio. I think, you know, if we look at what the RBA is likely to do, you know, looking at the forward implied curve, which is simply a measure of what the market is expecting the RBA to do, this may shock some of you, but, you know, 4 months ago, it was forecasting 2 rate cuts this year. As of May, the forward curve is implying, you know, nearly 5 rate cuts. More likely 4, but nearly 5 rate cuts. Now, that's probably more of a reflection of the uncertainty around trade, tariffs, noise, geopolitics. But the market is really getting ready to factor in 4 to 5 rate cuts. That would be advantageous to bonds. It would be advantageous for all hard assets. So property, you know, particularly, will benefit in that cycle. You know, more broadly in property markets, we've seen a massive underbuild, not just in residential, but, you know, things like shopping centres, things like office towers. You know, the replacement costs are very high. We haven't built much. And a lot of these, you know, their cap rates went up. When interest rates went up, i.e. valuations went down, if interest rates come down by 100 to 125 basis points, bringing the cash rate to below 3, that's going to have a huge, powerful impact on property prices in this market.
Yeah, it's so interesting how it all goes in together. So with the bonds, and then we rotate into property, just on the bond point you mentioned, I think, I can't remember the gentleman's name, the current treasurer of the US, he mentioned that something like if he got the bond rate down from 5 to 4, then essentially the deficit, the debt which has to be paid back purely on the interest, is something ridiculous, like, was it $100 million or something insane. And then what, the next day you saw the largest bond trade in history when, in a sense, China gave the middle finger and essentially said, we're not going to let this happen. You know, what is the impact of, and will they even let it happen, you know, for that 10-year bond rate to essentially fall? And what does that mean for, say, you know, the impact on Australia and Australian property?
Yeah. So look, I think, again, it's all noise. I mean, when the tariffs were first announced, the currency in the US was more volatile than it's been in 20 years. The 10-year yield curve or 10-year bond moved the most in a day since the tech wreck in the 2000s. And the 30-year bond rate moved the most in a week than it ever has since the 1980s. This is not what first world countries do. This is what emerging markets do that are on the brink of default or politics is out of control. So again, I think it's unorthodox. I think he creates noise to start the negotiating tool. His first deal, the offers, is not it's not the end. It's the starting point for negotiations. I do think. Look, the interesting thing is, and I was looking at some stats today. You've had bond yields come down substantially everywhere around the world, even in Germany where you've got that massive fiscal spending, even in the US where you've got instability. It's around the concerns around growth and concerns around tariffs. But interestingly, at the same time, the forecasted or what the market is expecting around inflation expectations has risen substantially. And so people are expecting higher inflation, but they're expecting lower interest rates. So that's inconsistent, but it could be people fearing around that instability in US policy, but also the dreaded stagflation fear.
Yeah, it's very interesting to see how this all plays out. So when this plays out and the volatility and everything settles, I mean, maybe a better question is, which everyone's kind of thinking, you're looking at the market today. Right, you know, you've seen this play out in a huge amount of volatility, multiple different ways, and then all of a sudden, they've come out with the negotiations. There's like a 90-day hiatus on. We won't impact these tariffs. Everything's stable. Looks like the market's starting to rally. A bunch of green in the screens. Do you think this is here to stay for a period, or are we pretty much like one headline away from it all unfolding again? Like people, a lot of people are asking. Like you know, it's I know it's definitely a. You know, which way is the wind blowing type of question. But from an asset allocating perspective, one of my colleagues mentioned it's very, very difficult to invest in this current market because you're damned if you do, you're damned if you don't. So I'm just wondering, with everything playing out right now, do you think it's kind of stabilized a bit for the next couple of months, or you need to sleep with one eye open?
I think markets are always difficult to invest. I think structurally, long-term, you want to be in the market. I think timing the market is inherently difficult, and that's not a cop-out, it just is, right? You can always have an excuse of not investing in the market. Now, if I look at the market now, everybody has a strategic weight. Like, you'll have your asset allocation, and your strategic weight to equities may be 10%, it could be 20, it could be 50. I would say at this point, you know, you would want to be, you know, slightly less in your strategic weight. And the reason I say that is I think it's going to be volatile up until February, March next year. And why do I say that? I think he's got a lot to do. This is his final term. The midterms are November next year. Now, the Republicans will be very, very, very aware that they do not want to lose their Senate majority, 53-47 for the Democrats. He will make a lot of noise until the campaign starts for the midterms. You know, they don't want to lose the House. They don't want to lose members, effectively. They've got the majority in the Senate, but they don't want to lose, you know, that he doesn't want to be a lame duck president. And so I think a lot of noise until February. I also think that markets are expensive. You know, the US market is not cheap. Maybe it doesn't deserve to be cheap, but you're not being paid up. And if there's another bit of volatility, the market can fall. So I think in this environment, you want to, you know, be overly diversified. You want to have some key, you know, thematics, and that's why we set those three, you know, non-USD versus USD, rest of the world versus US market, and, you know, more active, more small, more mids versus large caps. I think you then want to be opportunistic in you know, allocating to things like alternatives with much lower correlation and much lower reliance on the market. I think there's definitely an opportunity for private credit. I think there's definitely an opportunity in property selectively. And I think you just got to look at every investment. But I think in terms of broad market indices and large caps and US dollar investments, you probably want to be slightly to moderately underweight.
Thanks for that, Jason. One thing we've been discussing here with the family, which they do, as everyone knows, they do specialize in the property space. But one thing which we've seen, which has been so exciting to experience, has been the changes in New South Wales. To your point about, you know, the houses are expensive, you know, middle class can't afford to essentially purchase. So they've come out and proceeded to put in zoning changes, like across the board in areas that you would never have thought that would occur. That was at 400 metres from essentially a city centres, and there's a number being named. And then practically overnight, with the stroke of a pen, some of these R2 or R3 dwellings can now build to 6 to 9 stories high, when it used to only be essentially a 2-story DA allowed. So can you give a bit of a colour around for the people in New South Wales that may have missed it, or the people that live externally, of what's actually changed in New South Wales with the zoning and how that may impact property, please?
So these are called transport orientated development sites. Now, effectively, what we saw over the last 20, 30 years is how difficult it is to build things in Sydney, particularly with local government approval. So with the stroke of a pen, the New South Wales government implemented a policy that I think it's within 200 metres of a major transport corridor, you can build 6 to 8 stories. And within 400 metres, you can subdivide without council approval. Now, it is probably, I would argue, maybe the only reform the entire country has seen in the last decade. It is really the most powerful reform to improve supply of housing. Now, it's kind of under the radar. I would probably argue that there's probably a lot of annoyed people in some of the North Shore, or the, you know, let's say the Eastern Suburbs, the North Shore particularly. Why did New South Wales feel they could do this now? Now, if you think about the amount of investment that is going on, particularly in the Sydney Metro project. So now that the Northwest city is opened, you'll then have Bankstown Metro, which is being completely converted to a metro system. Next, I think, opening at the end of the year, early next year. And then you have the giant one, Metro West, which will go all the way to Parramatta in less than 20 minutes. Now, this is very different to a suburban rail network. These move people around very fast, and they enable a lot more density. The fact of the matter is, we had two options in Sydney: close it to new residents, or build infrastructure like this country's never seen, which has been, you know, we're halfway through. The next stage is then, if you're building a $20 billion or a $40 billion metro project, you've got to build apartments and high rises around them. So I do genuinely believe this is a fundamental reshape of Sydney. It's a brave reform. I think there'll be a lot of pushback. It's been enacted. There's going to be a lot of pushback at the election. You're going to see some, it's not the federal election, the state election, which is sometime away off. But it's an exciting change, and something had to be done. And you can have governments pumping money into silly projects and spending $10 billion or planning to spend $10 billion, but it actually achieves nothing. This is a big reform, and it was, I argue, it's needed.
It's amazing. There's probably, you know, a couple of people listening in right now that it's either incredibly popular for or not popular for at all. And could you imagine, you woke up the next day and essentially, depending on the side of the street you are on in a particular suburb, it's like your house went up dramatically in value, or essentially you missed the boat by like a meter. Like,
look, I think how they done.
I'm hearing also as well a number of the people living in congested suburbs, like these things can go up. The number of cars coming in the roads, the transport, the roads can't handle the amount of traffic as well. So it's an isn't it an infrastructure problem as much as it's an opportunity for?
So the key here, Murdoch, is that these TDOs are being developed around mass transportation systems. If it's an existing train line on New South Wales Trains, if it's a new station for the Metro project particularly, so if you think about what's going to happen at Crow's Nest, North Sydney, you know, it's going to be concentrated in those areas, and also major bus interchanges. It makes no sense to have a metro project at Crow's Nest and have houses sitting on 600 or, you know, square meters of a block, right? Population grows, it's a fact.
Yeah, it's great. Do you see this, if it's successful in New South Wales, expanding to the rest of the country?
No idea. No idea. Look, I think if you look at Brisbane, it's a single council. Brisbane is pretty easy to do things. So Brisbane is one giant council. Next to another giant council, the Gold Coast. So it's pretty easy to, not pretty easy, but it's easier to deliver. The problem here is if you propose something, councils could reject it. And then there was a way to get, you know, state significant development approval, which was costly and hard and time consuming. So I think Sydney was unique in the number of councils.
Isn't just fascinating. It's the council was just removed. It's just like we're making the decision at the top and you need to jump, otherwise you're not going to get funding. And the question is how high. It's just, and the most interesting thing, as you mentioned at the beginning, I think there hasn't been a change of this kind since like the 1930s. And it was like when the new airport came in, this is huge, but apparently, you know, our friends are saying that was like 1% equivalent of this change. It's just such a dramatic effect with the stroke of a pen overnight in New South Wales. So, look, if anyone wants to know more about this topic, we love discussing it, so please reach out after. But in the light of just time, just moving on, does anyone have any specific questions they want to ask?
Can be as controversial as you like.
Yeah, we love it. Get into the detail.
We do have some pre-submitted questions actually lodged in course there. From Michael, in terms of, I mean, we may have covered it already so to some extent, what will happen to the US dollar from here more so, and the impact on the Australian dollar as well, that Jason and Melvin?
Yeah, so I think the US dollar will, you know, it's world, it still produces the most amount of innovation, but I think the next stage after tariffs and trade will be some type of agreement that the US dollar needs to appreciate. Now, you know, most currencies have already done that. So the euro has rallied quite substantially. The yen, Australia's been a little bit left behind. The Australian dollar is quite unique. The Australian dollar, it's, you know, a top 10 currency in the world, may even be in the top six in terms of tradability. And so a lot of investors around the world use this, and I'm talking about hedge funds and investment banks, they use the Australian dollar as a proxy on China. So if they want to, because you can't trade the Chinese currency. So if you want to express a view that's negative on China, which China's been a growth, low growth state for the last, you know, couple of years, people have expressed that by being short the US, by being short the Australian dollar. So look, I think the Australian dollar is going to be more linked to China and commodities, but more broadly globally, including Australia, I think we've seen the peaks of the US dollar.
Excellent. Thank you, Jason. We also had another one jump in there as well in terms of, well, the outlook for the Australian resource sector.
So
I know that's one that's very pertinent.
Yes, there's a few things. So gold, obviously, what we've seen in this instability is, you know, record gold prices. And so gold has been one of the best performing assets over the last 3 years. Australia produces a lot of gold. So I think our, you know, export numbers will hold up. I think the cyclical stuff is really hard because China is so weak. This may be a little bit controversial, but, you know, we've also done everything we possibly can to make it harder for our resource companies. You know, we're putting more regulation, more, you know, time to get through environmental approvals, more rejections by the government. You know, this is one of the sectors that we are genuinely competitive in, and we're making it next to impossible. We could have been the single largest LNG exporter in the world, but we just decided not to be. Woodside is progressively going, Australia is too hard, I'd rather do this in the US. And they announced the giant Louisiana $27 billion US dollar project in the US yesterday. And that will come at the expense of investing in Australia. So I think we've really got to quickly decide if we want a resource sector. And if we don't, what else are we going to be good at?
Well, we just lost the Beetaloo Basin like a couple of years ago. It was all Tamboran had it up and running, Australian base, and then they got the Labor and the Greenies stepped in and made it challenging. So what did they do? They moved the company and the tax paid to essentially Delaware. They're still saying, hey, you're going to give me first contract into the Northern Territory. But it's just, isn't it insane how you've got it all in your backyard and through a few technicalities you make it too difficult, and they've just lost billions, hundreds of millions of revenue for like, multiple generations. It doesn't make any sense.
I won't make a political view on it because I think most political parties are at fault here. The problem you have is the seats to win. You know, if you can't communicate properly why we need a resource sector and why we may still need gas and energy, it's going to be very hard to win seats in the city, right? So I think you need someone who can communicate it very well. Why it's important, why we need to make, you know, one area that we have a comparative advantage in against the rest of the world, and political stability. If you think about most resource regions in the world, they're not in political stable areas. So we have that advantage. But it is quite sad to see that, you know, even our own countries are not making investments here and rather doing it overseas.
Yeah. So one thing we've discussed, you and I, some of our clients have allocated to, we've had a conversation on the podcast, but I just really want to cover it because, you know, resources are so important. What's your opinion on resource royalties?
Yeah, so look, I think if, you know, the commodity sector is always going to be there. So commodity companies are extremely cheap, extremely cheap. So maybe they should be, maybe China doesn't grow. Another segment that you can get exposure to indirectly is royalties. So effectively what commodity companies will do is they'll effectively sell some of their balance sheet and you're entitled to a percentage of gross revenue that those mines produce. You don't take operational risk. You don't take CapEx risk. You just get a percentage of commodity price of what you're selling. It typically has, you know, less cyclicality to it to, you know, commodity companies that have a lot of, you know, costs and cyclicality to their earnings. So I think royalties are a great asset class. I think it provides probably cleaner, less risky exposure to the industry, and it's growing. So, you know, there's a couple of royalty funds here that, you know, there's a broader range of royalties. It's just not resources. It can be pharmaceuticals. It can be IP. It can be music. It can be a whole bunch of things. So, again, those type of alternatives which have, you know, lower correlation to the rest of the market, I think is a good place to be hunting.
Excellent. Thank you, Jess. We just had some thoughts as well in relation to China and how they're booming with Evergrande when going belly up. However, China has recovered as a whole.
Yeah, so the property market Evergrande. So, look, I think that's there's still a lot of weakness in the property market. I think that, you know, when you don't have a population growing and you overbuilt houses, it's not a great spot to be in. China this time has been more targeted in its response in providing fiscal support. You know, no longer do we have the bazooka of just spending a whole lot of money. But I think the Chinese definitely turned a corner at the beginning of the year. And late last year, not just in terms of their economic response, but also their warm embrace of the tech sector. Now, a big part of why the Chinese market underperformed was when, you know, Jack Ma was effectively banned from being in the media, and this is Alibaba. So the government in China really went hard against the technology sector, and the technology sector stopped investing and stopped feeling like it could contribute to the economy. That fundamental shift in, I think it was November to February, of reintegrating that and bringing them back to the table was a big move. And then you had DeepSeek happen, and I think that's been the catalyst of why people are looking at China again.
Yeah, it all kind of ties into each other, doesn't it? One thing we haven't touched on is digital assets, you know, crypto. Just that on a whole, on a macro, and why this is interesting, it ties into the DeepSeek, it ties into NVIDIA, it ties into the infrastructure demand for natural gas or electricity, like the grid. You know, they're discussing now over in the US, like they've sold so many Tesla that the grid is in there to support essentially the electrical. You know, California was told stop charging your Teslas because we may have a brownout, and then they had the fire, right? So what I'm wondering is, you know, where do you think, where to for digital assets? You know, has it become more robust? The ETFs have been announced. You're starting to see, you know, private credit or essentially, you know, hybrid style scalping of, you know, the lending rates. You know, that, you know what I mean? Like these fund managers are starting to pop up offering, you know, 20% returns on just doing what old hedge funds used to do. It's, you know, scalping interest rates, moving one to the other. So, do you think the digital asset market is, I suppose, old enough now to be taken seriously? Do you think the demand from the resources, from the infrastructure, the economy, you know, is going to keep continuing this, or am I mad? Like, what's your opinion on the digital asset space currently?
So I'll be honest. I wish I bought digital currencies a long time ago. I wish I did. I was wrong, completely wrong. But I still... Now, obviously, I may not just get it, but I've been wrong, and I'll admit that. But I think still It's I don't gravitate towards it like some people do, but I did, and I wish I kind of understood it better. The new nascent asset class, there's the core hardcore believers. You know, there was a few events where, and this was wrong again, where I thought Bitcoin would have went up when it didn't, and that kind of shaped my view. When China implemented capital controls, I can't remember when it was, but when they introduced capital controls, I would have expected Bitcoin to rally because that was a way to potentially get money out of China. It didn't. I also expected Bitcoin to rally at the commencement of Russian sanctions. It didn't. So those two kind of points, and maybe Bitcoin is a lot larger than that, but the two points of, you know, capital controls in China and sanctions on Russia, I would have expected those countries to have warmly embraced Bitcoin to get money out of their economy, and it just didn't happen. But again, I was wrong, but I look at those two catalysts and it didn't happen.
Yeah, it's quite interesting how that all works. You said a quick question. I'll quickly summarize. With mass immigration, there's been some changes in laws in Australia, which I believe came into effect as of April. Yes, regarding foreign money coming in, you have to be a resident in order to own property, and you're locked out for essentially 2 years or something equivalent. Do you want to give a bit of color around that and how it may impact the Australian property market?
I haven't followed that aspect. The bigger aspect is the kind of pausing of the special investor visa. So this was a visa where bring 5 mil in, invest that in a pre-packaged product, which included some VC assets, venture capital. It included some listed microcaps and then a diversifying component. A lot of countries have these. New Zealand has just re-implemented their special investor visa and actually made it really easy, really, really easy. Trump, you still have to invest. Trump has announced a pure cash component, so pay 5 or 10 mil, whatever it is, and you get a visa on the spot. Look, Australia removed it. It did have an impact on some aspects, but there's ways to come in. I think there's another visa called the Innovators Visa where it costs 10 mil, and you've got to put it in a company that certain criteria. Look, it hasn't had a measurable impact on the luxury property market, but these new changes could very well. But the special investor visa, you know, the concerns around that was that it was bringing people with questionable backgrounds and money laundering. But a lot of countries have these, and Australia's taken a view that it doesn't want it.
Well, the US is bringing out the gold card now, right? But to my understanding, right, yes, it gives you 5 years, but if you commit a crime, you're out. So was the Australian version, if you committed a crime, like it doesn't guarantee you residency?
No, so I think it has to be invested for 3 to 5 years. And then at the end, you get approved. There's probably criteria. I'm sure if you committed crimes, you wouldn't get it, but criteria. But as soon as you meet that whatever term, you then apply and then you get it.
Anyway, thank you very much for joining us. I really appreciate the questions that you brought in for Jason. Jason, before we go, is there anything we haven't covered that's front of mind or, you know, a message you want to leave for everyone?
Yeah, look, while I said that markets were expensive, I think there's a lot of opportunity when drilling down. And so the role and what we do and what we spend all our time is trying to find those ideas. We don't want to be making wholesale shifts of pulling all your money out of the market and sitting in cash, but the portfolio definitely will evolve over time. I think it's, you know, in this environment, I wouldn't be jumping at shadows in terms of what comes out of the US. I would be, you know, taking a measured approach to managing my allocation to the market. And I, you know, it sounds a bit, a cop out, but it's a time in the market rather than trying to time the market. But if you can have some liquidity in the portfolio, you can tactically allocate when the market falls heavily. And maybe, you know, I do think to February next year, markets will remain volatile, but take advantage of you know, I'm not saying buy the dip, but if there is a meaningful drawdown, that's an opportunity to buy stuff.
So quite literally play red light, green light.
Pretty much. And I think that's what it's going to be for February.
So essentially play conservative with your core, and then essentially you have liquidity around, play red light, green light when the opportunity arises, is pretty much what you're thinking. Is that right, Jason?
Correct. And also be prepared, just lastly, I know everybody has to go, but, you know, interest rates are coming down. You know, the forward curve is pretty anchored in that kind of 3 or potentially below 3, whereas it's 4.1 now. That will have a powerful impact for the economy, you know, spending, all the way to asset prices, particularly hard asset prices that are priced off interest rates. So I think we are, you know, we saw just lastly, we saw, you know, office towers particularly, you know, see 30 to 40% declines. I think capital is coming back into that market as people realize we haven't built enough for a growing population. You know, shopping centers and retail, you know, Initium has a proud legacy in retail. I would say in some of the largest shopping malls, we've not built a single shopping center on a large scale in nearly 20 years. And the population has gone from 15 mil to 28 mil. So, you know, you see these property markets move in cycles. And I think when interest rates come down particularly, that is a very powerful driver of capital growth in property markets and hard assets.
Thank you very much for that, Jason. Thank you very much for joining us. If anyone wants to reach out, please do. Happy to talk to you after this if you have any specific questions. But in that case, thank you very much. And we will distribute this conversation around so you can hopefully listen to it again and pick up anything that you want to pick up. But thank you very much, everyone, for joining us. Really appreciate it.
Don't forget to vote.
That is true. Do not forget to vote. Thanks, guys. Jason. Bye. Thanks, Anthony.
Any use of this recording does not represent the view of any other third party and are the sole personal opinions of the speaker. Any reference to financial products does not constitute advice or recommendation, and before any action, you should seek proper advice from your financial professional. Australian listeners should head to www.moneysmart.gov.au to find more information on obtaining financial advice. To get in touch with York, head to our website, www.yorkwealth.com.au.